And I'm McKenna.
And together we're the Daily Profcast.
We're two long-distance besties
who share a love of Harry Potter.
We hope you enjoyed the episode. Welcome back to the Daily Profcast.
Today we are continuing our journey through Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
And it's
such a good journey. We're enjoying it immensely. And we're actually going to start off today's episode a little differently. McKenna, would you like to tell the people?
Yeah, so we just rediscovered how many amazing reviews everybody has left on our Apple Podcasts profile, where you can leave a review on the podcast. So we want to celebrate those. So, and encourage everybody to go leave reviews once you've listened. So if you're listening now, leave a review on our Apple Podcasts. And every week we're going to pick a new review to read aloud during the podcast.
Yes.
Just something fun and just to say thank you, because you guys are all like so amazing and these reviews are so touching and sweet, and
we really appreciate that you elect to spend your time with us.
Yeah, because we know these podcasts are long, and you know, it just makes us feel good that we have this little family of fellow nerds who want to hang out with us and talk about Harry Potter.
Yeah,
so this week's review comes from Derplaney. And she left this in January 15th.
We don't know if this is a she.
They left this review January 15th, and it's entitled, Wow. Say, words can't express how much this podcast has made the crappiness of 2020 so much better. Each new episode feels like I'm in the room with Aaron and McKenna chatting about our favorite series. Each week, this podcast brings me great joy, reminds me of wonderful little nuggets of lore that's left out of the films, and even makes me want to rewrite the series as a TV show. I cannot stop listening. I can't wait for Goblet of Fire and all the fun fan casting. Keep it up. You guys are amazing.
Thanks, Derplaney.
Thanks.
We appreciate you listening and hanging out with us.
Yep. Thank you so much. So with that, we can kick it off. We're going to be doing chapters 9 through 12 this week, right?
Yeah. And what this starts, you know, aside from the first chapter, the rest of this book so far has been fairly like sweet, and you know, we're at the Burrow and we're hanging out with the Weasleys, and it takes a nosedive in this chapter.
Yeah, literally a dark turn, which is why this chapter is aptly named The Dark Mark.
Yes.
So it's after the Quidditch World Cup.
They're going, everyone's, you know, having a party in the campsite. They have one last mug of hot cocoa and then everybody's going to bed. And there's, Harry is like laying in bed, like dreaming of playing professional Quidditch and being one of the players at the World Cup. And my Marauder's brain goes to, I bet you anything that at some point in his life, James Potter attended the Quidditch World Cup and was doing the same thing.
I know, it's so sweet. So, what's funny to this too is, you know, Ginny's going to actually go on to play Quidditch competitively. And I feel like we don't really get that notion here, but I wonder if the excitement of the World Cup like sparked something in her that like begins her Quidditch journey.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. I didn't think about that.
Just a little headcanon.
She's not on the team yet.
No. And she doesn't really.
Until next year?
Yeah. And she doesn't really talk about it, you know, the same way that the others talk about it. You know, like Ron and Harry are such like Quidditch stands, and even Fred and George are so like excited. And
you know, they're really into it. Yeah. Have we heard yet? Maybe we don't find this out till the next book, but have we heard yet about how she like goes and steals her brother's brooms from the shed and like goes and practices her flying?
I don't think we've learned that yet, but that's so cute.
Yeah. It's so cute. Anyway.
And I love that she falls asleep at the table in the...
She's still the baby.
I know. It just, and then Mr. Weasley's like, okay, everybody, time for bed.
That is the last good thing that happens in this chapter.
Yeah, because it's about to go down. So, you know, they're hearing all this commotion outside, which was the celebrating. Everybody goes to bed, and then Mr. Weasley wakes Harry up, and it's a different kind of commotion going outside. And this is really different from the movie. So when I reread this, I actually had to reread this chapter a couple times, and I'm not even sure still that like my mind really properly wraps my head around the order of events of how this all happens, because it's so different from the movie that is ingrained into my brain. I've watched this movie a lot because I think it has some of the highest independent rewatch value. So I don't know this. It just had to reread the chapter so many times.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I was on that sort of, along that sort of same vein. I Yes, this goes down very differently from the movie. Not only is it more detailed, it's just like a different chain of event. It's a completely different chain of events.
It's a little great.
It's totally chaotic, and it's supposed to be. I don't know that when I read, I like really get a mental image. Like I'm somebody who, everyone, you know, has a different reaction in their own head when they read. Some people don't see anything. Some people like really see it in their mind's eye. I'm somebody who really tries to see everything in my mind's eye. And I still don't know if I really have a grasp on how it looks to me, if that makes sense.
No, I have the same thing. I'm somebody, I think like you, I put a movie together in my mind of what's going on. And so typically I have like my own versions of the characters,
it's my maladaptive daydreaming coming through.
Right. I know the way that it looks in my head from a setting perspective. And this chapter, I think I just couldn't put together a vision in my mind of how everything happens. And when I was reading, and I know it's, like you said, it's written to feel very chaotic, but it really is. It just feels so chaotic when you're reading this. I can't even put together a proper timeline, really, of how everything happens. It just feels like such a disaster.
Yeah. Yeah. And if we're thinking about what happens, it is. So this is our very first glimpse of Death Eaters. And now we've met characters in previous books that we know were Death Eaters, but this is them in uniform with the masks on, committing an act of terror at a really public event.
Right.
And enjoying it.
This is the first time we see the Death Eaters in action. And I think this is the first time that we've had this sort of large display of pro-Voldemort like sympathy in a very long time, obviously.
Yeah, this publicly.
Which is jarring to both, obviously, the children, but the adults who have already been through this and survived this once before.
Absolutely. I always think about this. If we could read this chapter from another character's perspective, let's say Arthur Weasley, like the absolute like resurfacing of trauma and terror that must be happening because he's seeing this, because he was alive during the first war. He wasn't in the Order of the Phoenix. He wasn't like actively out there fighting, but he would have, you know, seen all the headlines and seen what happened and all this stuff. So you're right. I think it's really confusing and scary for the kids because of how chaotic it is. But I think it's like emotionally really scary for the adults. It says, so it's describing this, like, it says like a fairly small group of masked witches and wizards walking through, and then a bunch of like drunk people joining them. And later it's like, oh, these are all former Death Eaters. And I'm like wondering, I'm like, is this just like the Hoy who is just like secretly sympathetic to what Voldemort's cause used to be? And was just like, not actively a Death Eater, but on that side of the war. Like, who is joining this group? This is terrifying. They're levitating and terrorizing a Muggle family. It's the Roberts.
I sort of think of this, not to sort of make everything political, but there's a lot of parallels to draw from what we're going through as a country, in the US at least, right now. There's always a group of like extremists, you know, and then there are the people who follow behind and perhaps are not like immediately brave enough to be the first ones in, but who are definitely okay joining into the crowd.
Yeah.
And like wrecking their own, you know, brand of havoc.
All this stuff that's going on in this book is really making me wish we just got more in-depth history and content about the First War, just like politically and like historically. And this, it just makes me wonder if there's a group of witches and wizards who are maybe weren't a Death Eater again, but were like sympathetic. And we're like, well, like maybe it would be better if we didn't have Muggleborns.
My life would be better if I didn't have to compete against Muggleborns, or if I didn't have to live amongst Muggles. Like, they used to stone us and drown us. This is obviously a much better
way of life. And they're getting sort of sucked up into the mob mentality, and they're like okay with it. And we even see from some of our characters these like microaggressions, not necessarily just like against any group, werewolves, house elves, like these like sort of ingrained ideals about other groups. And so clearly there's got to be a group in the wizarding world that's just, yeah, like muggle-borns are inferior, you know?
Right. And
that's terrifying that they can just get sucked up into something like
this entire situation with Voldemort and the Death Eaters and this pure blood rhetoric. It's important, I think, to note that this is a direct, not comparison, is not the
it's
word.
It's a direct parallel to like Nazi.
Parallel to Nazism, right.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see what we know about Voldemort, especially in his like earlier life, is he was very charismatic and he attracted a lot of people to his cause because he was so like an excellent orator. We see it a lot when he does his monologuing that he, you know, he knows how to twist people and sort of get them onto his side. And we know a lot with Adolf Hitler is that he was able to basically tell a large portion of Germans, you know, your problems are caused by this particular group of people. And if these people didn't exist, or if we filtered them out, we would be basically at the height of our powers. You know, we would be a much better Germany without these people. And I think that's, the author did this on purpose. And you know, there's lot debate. Of controversy if that was a
there's debate, you know? As to whether there's the, I don't think so much the Nazi rhetoric, but like, as far as there's debate as to whether her writing in the struggles of the Jewish people was really for her to write.
Yeah.
And reflecting that in as what the Muggleborns go through. But I it's definitely scary. Like the parallels to like Nazi eugenics, and especially coming up, if we can just go ahead a little bit. So, you know, Mr. Weasley wakes everybody up. He tells all the kids that are underage, so Fred and George on down to Ginny, you know, you guys go into the woods. Him and Bill and Percy and Charlie run off to go try and face the Death Eaters and help the ministry, which I'm like, you guys go.
I know. Yes. It's so, I could, oh,
you're so
I don't
brave.
Know. Mr. Weasley with his sons. I don't know. That's a like sad, but like a proud moment too. I don't know. Just totally. The character he passes on to his children.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, so they're running into the woods and who should they encounter but Draco?
Who's surprised?
He's really calm. And Harry totally hits the nail on the head. He's, you know, are your parents in there with masks on? And Draco doesn't really deny it. He's like, well, if they were, I wouldn't tell ya. And he says something that utterly disturbed me. And he was like, you know, you guys better keep running. He's all calm, but everyone's running away. He's like, you guys better keep running. You want to make sure they won't spot her. He's talking about Hermione. He's like, they're after mudbloods, he says. And the fact that, and then he makes a comment about how her hair's bushy, and the fact that he is likening her blood status, something that is internal about her, to something that is external that can be seen, is like directly out of Nazi propaganda about the Jewish people looking a certain way and having certain features, and that's how you can identify them. And it's really disturbing, this idea that, oh, you can smell out a Muggle-born. No, that's not even, it's not even accurate. It's like outdated, and it's propaganda, but it's really gross the way he talks about it.
Yeah, I think this is a pertinent time to sort of mention that people who are, I want to say, sort of like simp over Draco and romanticize Death Eaters, and you have to understand how that is offensive to a lot of people, because this really was written to reflect, you know, Nazism and the genocide of an entire group of people, you know? Yeah. And so when we, you know, Draco is an interesting character and there's a lot to examine about him, but we also have to talk about, you know, he's not just a cute little blonde haired boy who's emotionally tortured, you know, he's a propagator of really serious offenses. And his parents are Death Eaters and they're pretty proud to be them. And they live that rhetoric pretty openly. And
yeah.
So I don't know. I just think of a lot of people who, you know, wear the Death Eater masks on videos on TikTok and I don't know, just sort of romanticize this whole group of people, institution. Yeah. And I don't think it's something to sexualize and make light of, you know,
when it's not,
get the Dark Mark tattoo. It's like, it's the Harry Potter equivalent of basically getting a swastika. You know what I mean? It's not a...
And it's, you know, people are like, oh, well, it's fiction. Well, fiction has parallels to real life.
Yeah, this is, yeah, it is. It's a
this is literally, there's no shrouding it. This is literally a parallel to fascism. And so you're right. Absolutely. I agree with you. I think, I hope that the people who, not to gatekeep, because I think anybody can enjoy the Harry Potter series, but I sincerely hope that the people who do really love like Death Eater culture and like romanticize
that, being like a Death Slytherin Eater and like aesthetic.
being with Draco when he's going through and getting the Dark Mark for him or whatever the heck people on Wattpad do. But I sincerely hope they haven't read the books. And I sincerely hope they decide to, because I think you'd make a different choice.
Right. And I think there's a lot of really interesting fan fiction out there about the House of Black or about the Malfoy family. And there's a lot of things to be explored there, but I think you can't take the good, or you can't write the good without acknowledging that there is a lot of bad there.
Yeah.
So just now, I guess something for the fandom to consider. And of course, you know, Aaron and I are not Jewish, and we obviously cannot speak for Jewish creators, but there has been a lot of silencing of Jewish creators lately. And so I think just to go along with this sort of topic, we'll put maybe a couple links in our bio of some Jewish creators who talk a lot about these ideas who would be good to follow and listen to.
Yeah.
Direct sources rather than the two of us, but just something to be aware of. I've seen a lot of just romanticizing this stuff. And when you reread this chapter and you see them just basically playing with muggles like they're meat, you know, like they're just tossing them around. It's just so disturbing.
It's really disturbing. Now, the only sort of redeeming thing that comes of this interaction is, again, for the however many time, we see Ron being the first one ready to like charge at Draco for Hermione. Yeah. Now you get this image in your head of, you know, we know Hermione can handle herself and she doesn't like need a man to come save her. But Ron, this is another thing. Again, I'm going to, you know, beat a dead horse, but like we totally missed this side of Ron in the films. The fact that he's so loyal that he will go to bat for Hermione for any time anybody comes for her, especially about her blood status. And I think it's very sweet that he's always ready to risk life and limb to defend Hermione.
Yeah, I think it's really, I don't want to say admirable because it's sort of an obvious, but I think it's really important the way the Weasleys raise their children.
Yes.
To really understand that this is a prevalent issue within the wizarding community and that it's wrong. You know, and that even though they're part of the Sacred 28, both Molly's, you know, maiden family her married family are both part of the Sacred 28, you know, these pure blood wizarding lines, and their family has gone against that traditional rhetoric and just been like, well, we love and accept all, and that's how we raise our children. And I think that is important, but it's also very interesting to know, and we're going to see it in this chapter, that Ron does have a lot of internal biases, maybe against other parts of the wizarding community, like you mentioned werewolves. We're going to see it with house elves, you know, a lot in this book. So just interesting to see the way all of these things manifest.
Absolutely. We get our first mention of another magic school. Yes. We encounter some French girls and they're asking, where is Madame Maxime? And Hermione's like, oh, they're from Beauxbatons. And Harry's like, who? What? She's like, it's the French Wizarding School, duh, haven't insert book here, have you read in? Yeah. And and we're gonna get Durmstrang later on. It's sort of weird the way this is written. We were talking about how it feels really chaotic, and I almost feel like the writing is overly chaotic. Like, it's not very streamlined. It like starts bringing up, and I guess this is just like how, you know, maybe how Harry's witnessing it. Like, he sees one thing and then he sees another group of people and then he sees another thing. But there's like a mention of goblins and there's some like things. I'm like, why are you talking about this? Like, shouldn't they be running? Like, why are they stopping to look at goblins and people from Beauxbatons and what's going on?
So they're running into the woods and we see Winky again. And I think the line is something like, it was, she's running and she's, how do I explain this?
She like can't really run properly.
Can't really run properly. She's just not coordinated very well. And there's a line that it was almost as though someone invisible were trying to hold her back. This is important.
Yes.
It's so hard because I'm always like, do we give up the secrets here or do we just like mention things and then talk about it later?
We could probably talk about that one in a little bit when Winky gets caught red-handed.
Right.
We see Stan Shunpike again.
Yes. Who?
He's flirting with some Vila, even though everybody should be running for their lives.
Like, will become a Death Eater.
Yeah, that makes me really sad.
It makes me really sad,
because I love seeing him on the night bus, and then to know, and this is what I'm talking about. It's like, now he does become a Death Eater, but just, you know, he was talking super derisively about Sirius Black on the night bus, and somehow he gets sucked up into the cause.
Right, and I think that's just the way...
We all like to think that, you know, people like to say, well, if I was in Nazi Germany, I would have fought back. And I think probably 90%... of us who say that like to say that, but that's probably not what would have happened.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about this, about what our country is going through right now, about what other countries in the world are going through, is we see a rise of a lot of sort of alternative leadership, non-traditional leaders who are coming more into power, who have these really big platforms that they're on. I think of like Boris Johnson, that woman in France who's running against Macron, obviously Donald Trump. A lot of these platforms that come out, and it's not new, and it's obviously visible in history. It's just about making you feel like all of your problems are because somebody else is getting ahead unfairly. Yeah. And if those people like didn't have access, so it's sort of naive to think that any of us are really above falling into these traps. And I think that's why continually educating is really important and just being super aware of our place in the world. But somebody like Stan Shunpike, it's, you know, it's disappointing, but at the same time, you know, you can understand because that's how these people get you. They play on your emotions.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Bummer.
Then we stumble across Ludo Bagman.
Who has no idea what's going on.
He has no idea what's going on. And I'm like, what is he doing there?
Isn't this your situation?
I haven't read ahead. McKenna's read a little bit ahead of me. I haven't really read ahead. And I can't remember what he's doing there. He sort of has a weird demeanor about him. And he's just like stumbling around the woods, and they're like, oh yeah, there are a bunch of Death Eaters back at the camp. Or they don't know they're called Death Eaters. They just say they're like people in masks. And he's like, and he disapparates away to go help. But what was he doing in the woods?
Well, Ron tells us they're called Death Eaters, right? That's the first time we hear the term Death Eaters.
Is it Ron or Mr. Weasley? I don't remember. One of them.
Also, I wanted to ask you, how many Death Eaters do you think show up? And which Death Eaters do you think are there?
So this is a really great question.
I looked up a lot of things.
The Death Eater numbers, right. Death Eater numbers are a little bit wonky. So
the author's not great at math. So all numbers are wonky.
Every number is wonky. But allegedly, so there are like tiers in the Death Eater system. There's Voldemort's most trusted Death Eaters that get the Dark Mark. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's like his inner circle. Then there are, so like the Malfoys are up in there. And then there are like the dark creatures. So Fenrir Greyback, who doesn't have a dark mark, but is considered a Death Eater. So, you know, werewolves and these dark creatures. And then there's like followers who, I don't know if you can call them Death Eaters or not, but they're not marked. And that tier has, it has been said that there are about 500 people in there. Now, when you consider that the Order of the Phoenix has 20 people, that's like terrifying.
Yeah.
But so if I'm going to guess who's there, definitely the Malfoys. You know, we see Crabbe.
Well, definitely Malfoy. We don't know.
Yeah.
Because Narcissa wasn't a Death Eater. She didn't have she didn't have the Dark Mark.
Really?
Yeah. I will Google it right now, but I am 99.9% sure that she was not in it, like an inducted Death Eater.
I would... considering what, you know, Bellatrix I would think she was probably. Because this
is the thing, this is like a big topic because everybody always says, oh, Narcissa, she wasn't even a Death Eater. She didn't have the dark mark. She was just trying to protect her son. She's not guilty.
She's like, totally guilty.
You're totally guilty.
You can be culpable even if you're not, you know, if you don't have the tattoo.
J.K. Rowling explicitly stated in a web interview that Narcissa Malfoy was not a Death Eater. She never had the dark mark and was never a fully paid up member.
You can be a Death Eater without the dark mark.
However, her views were identical to those of her husband until Voldemort planned the death of her son.
Yeah, so guilty. But so maybe Narcissa's not marching with them, but certainly Lucius, you know, maybe Crabbe and Goyle Sr. we see later in the, am I thinking of the movie? But we see them in the graveyard, right? Walden McNair has not been put in Azkaban. Travers and Mulciber are in Azkaban. Bellatrix and the Lestranges are in Azkaban. Who's not in Azkaban right now?
The Zabini family, were they Death Eaters? Blazes?
No. At least they weren't named mentioned and had the dark mark. Yeah. Don't know about their, you know, their stance on the topic. But so Lucius, Walden McNair, Corban Yaxley, Mulciber and Travers, Evan Rozier died. Maybe like Wilkes and Avery could be there. Because I think Mulciber and Travers are both in Azkaban. Oh no, Avery did get captured. Oh, Dolohov? No, Dolohov's in Azkaban. I need to go back and look who's out and who's in Azkaban right now after the first war.
Wormtail wouldn't have been there.
No, Wormtail would not have been there. Barty Crouch wouldn't have been marching, or Barty Crouch Jr. would not have been marching around with them because he's supposed to be dead. So the spoiler.
Not could have been there.
He wouldn't have been marching around in a mask, I don't think. Well, he could have been, and then just broke off later.
No, not N-O-T-T.
Theodore Knott's either dad or uncle or whatever. Probably one of the Knott family.
What about the Carrows? They could have been there, perhaps.
The Carrows could have been there. Now, we have to remember, so this grouping here is sort of weird because the big failure of the ministry after the first war was a lot of people got off scot-free because they said, oh, I was imperious. And you had Mulciber, who was not Mulciber Sr., Mulciber Jr., who was at school with the Marauders. And, you know, he was sort of the like Death Eaters, like imperious curse expert. And I think he basically testified that he put up all these people under the imperious curse, even though, you know, most of them were actually willing participants. So a lot of people got off scot-free and the ministry didn't really pursue it further. But when Voldemort went away, a lot of these people just stopped looking for him. So these aren't the people, I don't think, that were the people who just kind of stopped looking for him. These are people who are still sort of involved. Because those people he's coming back.
Yet. Bellatrix was in Azkaban, wasn't she?
Bellatrix was in Azkaban.
She would have loved to show up.
There would have been a lot more dead people if Bellatrix had been there.
Yeah. That girl crazy.
she cray. But yeah. So this is sort of a weird, like, who is in this group?
Yeah.
And I think it's scarier that we don't know. Because, you know, they're going up against these people who are there from the ministry, like the ministry security. There could very well be people who work in the ministry or at least have influence in the ministry, cough Lucius Malfoy, among this group of Death Eaters. So and you would never know because they're masked.
Right. And I think what's interesting about this is maybe you have a different perspective or maybe perhaps I'm even wrong about this, but these people don't know Voldemort's coming back. I'm pretty sure Voldemort's plan is like very hush.
And it's a question that I had because is this a group of people that Wormtail was like, hey, go do this distraction for Voldemort, or like Barty Crouch Jr. did that? Because Barty Crouch Jr. was like actively, he wasn't just, you know, it would be fun if I like totally took over Mad-Eye Moody's life.
Right. My understanding though is that it's a very obviously inside circle of Wormtail and Barty Crouch Jr. who know this plan. And I'm not necessarily sure that all of these other people knew. Maybe they could have been.
I'm wondering if it was like delegated. But then again, you know, Voldemort later in the graveyard will chastise the people who show up for not looking for him further. So maybe they just decided to get, maybe just like a little Death Eater reunion outside of Voldemort's plan. They're just like, you know, it would be fun if we just like totally terrorized everybody at the World
Cup. Just like for old time's sake.
Yeah, honestly, probably that's what happened. But it's a good question. The sort of, you know, planning around it is nothing we get to hear about because this is from Harry's perspective. But this is a terrorist attack. This is meant to strike fear into everybody, and it works. They go into the woods. They find Ludo. He leaves. Then this weird spell is cast, and we get this giant thing in the sky that's like this. They say it looks like it's made out of emerald stars, and it's smoky. It's a skull with a snake winding around it. This is the Dark Mark. This is
Hermione's like, this is the Dark Mark.
Duh. Yeah, of course.
Like, thanks for not letting us know before then, Hermione.
Yeah. But this is Voldemort's mark. It's the mark he puts on his closest followers as the tattoo as we know it. And it's also the mark that goes up in the sky every time the Death Eaters commit murder. So, and Arthur Weasley talks about it in the first, where he said, he was like, you could show up back at your house and see that the Dark Mark was in the sky over your house and walk in and your entire family would be dead. And that's why, you know, it's talking about how they see this spell go up and the mark materialize in the sky and they hear screams all around the woods.
Yeah.
So it's clearly something very meant to freak people out because it's got a history, like this really dark history of, you see this mark, there's been a murder. But there hasn't been a murder, which is, so this is just meant to terrorize.
Yeah, it just riles people. It makes people start questioning, is Voldemort back? Is this just his followers putting on a little show?
Which makes it even weirder thinking about like the group that's doing this, the group of Death Eaters that's doing this. Is it planned or are they, because it seems very, you know, it's very aptly timed for what happens later this year. So it's very strange.
Yeah, it's a big question mark.
But all these Aurors show up.
Yep.
And Barty Crouch is like trying to interrogate.
First time we get
kids.
To meet Aurors.
First time we get to meet Aurors. But, you know, actually, it doesn't explicitly say, does it explicitly say they're Aurors? Because Barty Crouch Jr. is not actually an Auror. He used to be in charge of he used to be the head of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement. Now he was like demoted after the first war to right. head of the Department of International Magical Cooperation. So I think this is like whoever was on security. So they said there was a team of stunners. That's probably a team of Aurors that's specifically out of the, you know, Department of Magical Law Enforcement. So I'm assuming there are Aurors there, but it never says. I hope there are. I so wish we saw more stuff about Aurors. I think it's so cool. But they find Winky with Harry's wand. Harry lost his wand in the hubbub. And Winky's got Harry's wand, and she's standing right under where that Dark Mark was cast. And she's denying it. She's like, how could I even, you know, use a wand? And Hermione is even, you know, the voice we heard cast the spell and speak the incantation, that was not Winky's voice. That was like a person.
Right.
But Amos Diggory, oddly, is being, he's in the Department of Control and Regulation of Magical Creatures.
So he's like the head of disposal of magical creatures, right?
Yeah. So he,
what an odd person for the job.
I don't know if he's disposal, but at least regulation and control. And he's really at Winky. He's really going off on her, and she's, you know, poor little Winky is distraught. She's like, I don't remember anything. I didn't do it. And Amos is sort of, he like doesn't have a filter.
Oh, he like, doesn't.
Like we saw it with Harry earlier where he was like, well, yeah, Cedric kicked your butt in that Quidditch match. And it's, you know, he's probably the better flyer and like saying all these things. And people were like, okay, shut up. Even Cedric's like, Dad, stop, you know? But he's, you know, and then he starts to sort of implicate Barty Crouch as he's implicating Winky. And then he like doubles back and starts backpedaling because he doesn't have a filter when he talks. It's funny. Guys, I don't.
Mr. Crouch is like nervous. He's on edge.
Yeah, he is on edge. And you know, I think in the situation when you're there, you could probably attribute that to the fact that, you know, this group of Death Eaters had infiltrated this event. But we know that he's on edge for another reason.
Yeah, he has a lot of stuff going on in his home life right now. It's not going well.
I have a little bit of a problem with Winky's dialect.
Okay.
It reminds me of like, it's meant to make her sound unintelligent.
Mm-hmm.
She's not using proper grammar. And it's sort of reflective of the way people write how slaves speak in Civil War era stories. And it's a little problematic for me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It doesn't hit right.
No, it doesn't. And I don't like it. It gives me a weird taste in my mouth.
I think one of the worst parts of these books is the use of stereotypes in just really uncomfortable ways. You know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't make sense. Like, the Jewish stereotypes that are attributed to the goblins at Gringotts. Like, this voice that can be very stereotypical, just attached to Winky. And just with no it's just uncomfortable. And I think these are things that you're more apt to sort of pass over if you don't know what you're looking for, or if you're a kid and you're reading these books.
I wouldn't have had a second thought about it as a kid.
Yeah, but when
that's the issue.
Right.
And when you put kids are reading this and being like, oh, yeah, that's how like the little slave house elf talks.
Yeah, the unintelligent.
Yeah, it's not even accurate like dialect for, because, you know, the African-American slaves in the United States had a dialect. Like they had a dialect. I don't want to say the wrong word with it. I think I know what it's called, but I don't want to say the wrong word just in case. But it's not even like close to that dialect. It's like how, it's like a weird, like twisted version of how like a general populace would view that dialect. It's not detailed or researched. And so it leaves me with a weird taste in my mouth.
If anybody has and wants to share with us language around this
entomology stuff,
yeah, that would be more appropriate for us to use. I'm going to do research after this episode, but this is something I'm obviously ignorant on and could use learning.
Yeah.
But I do agree with your sentiment that it was an inappropriate use of this particular. Well,
Dobby doesn't talk like that.
Right.
Dobby uses like regular English. He speaks about himself in the third person. That's it. No. You know? But anyway, yeah, I noticed that when we met her in the Quidditch Cup stands, but anyway. Okay, so then they go back and Arthur starts explaining sort of why this is really bad. And Percy is like, well, of course Barty Crouch was going to sack Winky. Like, what a disobedient house elf for such an important man. And Hermione goes off on him. And the fact that Hermione is going off on Percy gives me so much joy.
Yeah, she does really tell him off. And I also think it's interesting that Bill, who is so like Percy in so many ways, was also a head boy, also got a ton of OWLs and nudes.
But way more chill.
But like way cool. It's just like, Percy, shut up.
Shut up. That's in the next chapter. I made a note about that. He's like, Percy, do us all a favor and shut up. It's awesome.
I meant to mention this earlier, but when they're talking about the dark mark and Hermione says she knows what it is, even though she never mentioned it to the team before, Ron says he doesn't get why the dark mark would be a terrifying concept, which I felt was very out of character, because I feel like Ron can be quite superstitious about Voldemort and the like, doesn't really like to say his name. You know, he's been
say his name out loud. Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed, but the dark mark, just because of what it represents, like that's not something that I think Molly and Arthur would like sit down and tell them about. So I don't know that it's necessarily, and that's not something what people would want to talk about, just like the general populace. So I don't know that's necessarily something that.
I think it's interesting that, you know, Hermione explains what it is and why.
And normally Ron's like, oh yeah, I know this thing because I grew up in Wizarding World culture. Yeah.
But Ron is just, well, that's not really that scary. Which is, yeah. I don't know, it just doesn't feel like very typical of his character.
So on to chapter 10, Mayhem at the Ministry. These next two chapters are very short.
Yeah.
And it's just like glimpses of, it's like, it's almost like Harry's glimpses of like what's happening in the world outside of where he is. This thing where Molly is, so they come home from the Quidditch World Cup, they go back, they sleep in the tent, probably not well, they get up early, they port key back home, and Molly is waiting for them out in the garden as they're coming home.
Weird that they did not leave that night.
Yeah, I assume that, you know, if there are people organizing port keys, they probably wouldn't be able to like organize them all that fast. I don't know. Maybe they don't, I don't know. But she's waiting in the garden, and the first two people she hugs are Fred and George. And I want to talk about this really quick because, yes, she says like, oh, I, you know, they got in a huge fight before they left because she was upset that they were making all these like Weasley's Wizard Wheezes and, you know, causing this chaos with those. And she hugs them. She's like, the last thing I did was shout at you. And like, I wouldn't have been able to live with myself if that was the last thing I ever said to you, blah, blah, blah. But also we need to remember that Molly's brothers, Fabian and Gideon, both with F and G initials, Fred and George were the initials for, Fred and George were named and as sort of a homage to Molly's brothers, Fabian and Gideon, who died, it's written, very brutally in the first war, killed like really diabolically by 5 Death Eaters, including Antonin Dolohov, who has a history for like wanting people to die in like a sick way and like not just like the normal Avada Kedavra, like in like, so probably died pretty brutally. Molly, who was not involved in the war, clearly that would have affected her.
Oh, of course.
That her older, that her, actually, we don't know if they were older. I had canon them as older, but I don't know. That her brothers were like murdered in the first war because they were members of the First Order of the Phoenix. And I think it's sort of interesting that Fred and George are the, is the first, when the Death Eaters come back and they terrorize this event, the first people she goes to hug are Fred and George. And I wonder if she just like has a recollection of her brothers.
I'm sure, definitely. And she obviously did not leave things on a great note with those two particular children before they left. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm sure as a mother being faced with what could happen and knowing definitely that it is an unfortunate possibility in these uncertain and troubling times, I'm sure. I can only imagine as a, I'm not a mom yet, but I can only imagine, you know, what that would feel like, being so powerless and knowing that 5 of your children and your husband, 5 of your children, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. 7 of your children,
7, all of them, all of them. Kids.
They're not all there in the movie. I don't think so. Sometimes
no, they're not.
Like,
no, Bill and we don't see Bill and Charlie, and I don't think we see Percy. And
I have major movie bias sometimes when thinking about
them, like only recalls the, because my brain thinks of, we've talked, you know, my brain thinks of images even when I read. So when I think of an image, sometimes the first thing it latches onto is the images from the film.
So all 7 of your beloved children and your husband are basically at a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
And make it home safe. I can only imagine, you know, her being home by herself and like, I don't know, just that worry that you feel, you know.
Totally.
It's very disturbing. And yeah, I don't know. I feel really, it's just, there's so many feelings reading these books, isn't there?
Yeah. Totally. This chapter makes me wish so much that we could have more chapters that weren't necessarily from Harry's perspective and we could just like see what was going on at the ministry.
Yeah.
I would die to see what was going on with the ministry right now.
This is the first time we get a mention of Rita Skeeter, who's obviously going to become very important in the remainder of this book. And, you know, is it here that Mr. Weasley is sort of misquoted, unfortunately? And Percy is like, so Percy's character is so interesting to me because he is obviously thinks he's very important and
wants to be
very important, right? And he has this job working for Barty Crouch Sr., who he views working in this particular department as just a much more important job than where his father works, obviously, in the sort of Muggle relations department. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just interesting to think of, you know, Percy as a little boy, sort of always wanting to grow up and work at the ministry and sort of follow in his footsteps. And then when Percy gets to that point, he's just so unimpressed by his dad and just very, I don't know, just like talks down to his father a lot and sort of discounts the contributions that he's making at the ministry.
What happens is Percy says something. Rita Skeeter Arthur is not directly mentioned, but Rita, in the commotion, like coming out of the woods after the terrorist attack at the World Cup, a bunch of people see Mr. Weasley, recognize him to be somebody who works for the ministry, and they're like, what's going on? What do we do? And he sort of is like, I don't know. Go back to your tents. I want to go to bed. And Rita Skeeter catches wind of this, and she doesn't mention him by name, but she's like, you know, a ministry official came out and was like very, you know, very uninformative and like really did not help dispel any rumors. And Arthur's like, oh crap, okay, I gotta go resolve this at work. So Percy says something to his mom along the lines of like, well, dad really shouldn't have said anything without permission from his superiors, or something along those lines. And Molly's like, don't you dare say that about your father. Also, you don't, like, you could not possibly understand what we're feeling about this, having lived through this already.
Right. Percy's just so unaware. Percy's all about Percy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I can, and just all this animosity between Hermione and Percy with Winky and, like, house elf rights is, I can just imagine the sort of, like, debates they would get in at family dinners later on in the Water family. Water being Weasley and Potter combined.
Yeah.
But, and then, so we send the kids up to pack for school, and
Mrs. Molly Weasley went to Harry's vault and got money for him.
Yeah, she like went and did their shopping in Diagon Alley for them, which like,
did he give her his key?
Must have, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. It's not really.
They must have like planned it. It's sort of glossed over. This chapter takes place over like a week, and we don't really, it's sort of glossed over. So.
Something else to note here is that Ron actually gets his dress robes right now. In the movie, Ron receives his dress robes by Owl sort of later on once they know about the Triwizard Tournament. So they don't know what's going to go. They don't know that anything's going down at Hogwarts at this point, but Ron just has these dress robes.
Mrs. Weasley was like, oh, they were on your list.
Yeah, so you need them.
Here they are. Harry's got some too. And Harry opens up she took some of Harry's gold that she got from his vault and went and bought him a brand new pair that are like emerald green. And Ron's like, this is the beginning of Ron's frustration this year. This is the seed that is planted for Ron to be really frustrated with Harry. And I think really just frustrated with his situation, but it sort of gets projected on Harry.
Yeah, I would say that this seed, if we really think about it, has been growing for a long time. I think it really, you really think about it, started in their first interaction on the train their first year when Harry's like, let's get everything on the cart. I have tons of money. Like, I'm wizard rich.
But, and you know, maybe as an 11-year-old, Ron was like, cool, my best friend's rich and can buy me all these goodies. Now as a, you know, turning 14-year-old, he's starting to really notice the disparity between Harry's financial situation and his financial situation. And the last line of the chapter is like, why is everything I own rubbish?
Right. And I can only imagine what it's like to be best friends with Harry Potter. I think that's the great dichotomy between Ron and Harry, is that Ron so much aspires to everything Harry is and has, and Harry so much aspires to everything that Ron has.
We talked about this in the very first book. They complete each other. But sometimes it also drives a wedge between them.
Right, because, you know, as boys do, I think they have a hard time understanding each other's emotions. Harry's like, well, why don't you understand that I would give anything to have family? And Ron is like, yeah, but family can be annoying. I want to be the Quidditch captain.
And Ron's like, your parents are dead in the seventh movie. Oh my gosh.
So anyway, the next chapter is
the journey on the, is it the journey on the Hogwarts Express?
Aboard the Hogwarts Express.
I'm getting all my, there's always a Hogwarts Express chapter and I get all the language mixed up.
So Amos Diggory sends a message, and this is the first time we see
face flu, a flu call.
Face flu.
I don't know what it's actually called. I just call it face flu.
And Sirius is going to use this later in the book to communicate with Harry, but I just thought this was really interesting. It's like FaceTime, wizard FaceTime.
It's totally wizard FaceTime in the fireplace, and Harry like does a double take because he just sees Amos Diggory's like head in the fireplace with fire. Like it's like roasting in there, but it's no, that's how they do their little calls. We get our first mention of Mad-Eye Moody.
Yes.
I Frick it, guys. If I'm going to pick like a third favorite character after Remus and Sirius, it's probably going to be Mad-Eye Moody.
He's a great character. I
love Mad-Eye Moody. I just love his character. He's so kooky.
And eccentric and weird.
Totally. And he's also like, he's also really cool and like badass. Like, take it out for later. He's also really cool and bad bleep. You know, he half it, and it says half the cell blocks in Azkaban are filled because of him, because of his like contributions during the first Wizarding War. So cool. He's so cool. But there's this line that literally, it's very rare that I read a book and I actually like out loud start laughing at something. This literally made me laugh out loud. Somebody says like, oh, like Mad-Eye Moody, like the crazy guy. And Molly's like, oh, your father has a lot of respect for Mad-Eye Moody. And Fred, or either Fred or George goes, yeah, well, dad collects plugs, doesn't he?
I love this.
They're like, dad literally collects plugs. So like, what are we, how are we like ranking this here?
So funny.
And then they order tack. Did you have anything else to say on that?
No, I don't think so. They order the taxis. I think it's...
How long is that taxi ride?
Has to be
Ottery St. Mary's, where Ottery St. Catchpole is based on, that's not close to London. Like, that's not... That's like a couple hours. They get in their train compartment and they hear Draco talking in the next compartment. I don't know if they... Yeah. And he's talking about like, oh, mother would have sent me to Durmstrang, or father would have sent me to Durmstrang, but mother thought it was too far away. And, you know, I would have preferred to go to Durmstrang. It's like Draco in a Harry Potter musical where he's like, I'll be transferring to Pig Farts. Because he's just like, Durmstrang doesn't admit the sort of riffraff that Hogwarts admits. And father's old friends with the headmaster at Durmstrang, because it's Igor Karkaroff, who's a former Nazis together. And it brings up a question. So, and Durmstrang has a notorious history for like being more, let's say,
forgiving.
Open about, not just forgiving, but like open about teaching students dark arts and having a more sort of liberal view on like letting students learn about them.
Specifically, somebody who we can note who received this sort of education at Durmstrang would be Gellert Grindelwald.
Yes, exactly. We actually don't know where Igor Karkaroff went to school. He, like, it sounds like he would have, Karkaroff is a Slavic surname. Mm-hmm. So maybe Koldovsterets, which is the Russian wizarding school. Or, you know, he teaches at Durmstrang. Perhaps he went to Durmstrang, but like, also he seems to have memories of Hogwarts. So we don't really know where Igor Karkaroff went to school.
No, this is sort of off topic, but something I would like to mention is how cool would it be if these students had an option to like
study abroad?
Yeah, like excelling students. Somebody like Hermione could go take classes for a year at the Russian Wizarding School or like the Wizarding School in Africa or something. It would be so awesome.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. There's one in Japan, South America.
Obviously one in America.
Yeah, Ilvermorny.
In the North America. Yeah.
I think there are 8 wizarding schools. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look. I'll go back and look at the list when we get to where the schools arrive.
Something that we skipped over is Hermione tells Harry and Ron about how they hide Hogwarts.
Oh, yeah. They say something weird. They're like, nobody really knows. Oh, no, we didn't skip over. We haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, I thought that happened before the Draco conversation. Mm-mm. Maybe my notes are just out of order.
Because I actually have a question before that. You know, Draco says Durmstrang doesn't admit that sort of riffraff. And he's talking about Muggleborns. He says Mudbloods, but he's talking about Muggleborn students. And I'm like, is that actually true? Does Durmstrang not admit Muggleborn students? Then are there, like, where do they go to school? Do they have to go to Beauxbatons? There are Muggleborn wizards in other parts of the world. And if they can't get admitted to a school, first of all, super problematic. Second of all, where do they go?
Right. I have no idea. That's a very good point. I didn't even
I'm wondering if that's just something that like Draco is like blowing smoke up their butts.
Yeah, it's just like his perception of the situation.
Yeah. And then Hermione's like, nobody knows where it is. Nobody knows where the school is, which is so weird to me.
Right. And the way they sort of describe it is that if Muggles were to stumble upon Hogwarts, there's some sort of magical protection at Hogwarts that would make Hogwarts basically look it would say, there would be a sign that says it's a dangerous building and it would look sort of run down.
Yeah.
And when I read this initially in bed, you know, Mike and I, we both read our Harry Potter books in bed before we go to sleep.
Oh my God, that's so cute. Goal. Austin, I know you're listening and that's the goal someday.
And I turned to Mike and I said, so if I'm a witch and I'm married to you, a muggle, and I want to like bring you to my alma mater for a Quidditch game because our magical child is there, would you not be able to recognize Hogwarts? Or is it like once you know it's there and you're like woke to Hogwarts? Yeah.
Woke to Hogwarts. That's my new favorite thing. I believe the facade is like a facade. And so you see the facade, you're like, I'm not going to go in there. But if you were to like walk into the grounds, you could see what was really there. So I think probably if you were going to like, if you were going to bring your muggle husband to a Quidditch match, if once you like bring them onto the grounds, they could probably be able to see. Yeah. I have no evidence to back that up.
Could you imagine like a witch like being like, come on, honey, let me show you my wonderful castle that I went to school in. And he's like, honey, this is a dump. We can't go in there. It's dangerous.
Yeah. Look, it's this danger. Keep out. Yeah, that is interesting. And it's also like, we know where these schools are now because like the canon like lore information has been provided to us. Like, I think Beauxbatons is in the Pyrenees Mountains and Durmstrang is, oh God, I don't actually remember where Durmstrang is. Northern Europe.
It's in Norway.
Yeah, is it in Norway?
Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be in like Northern Norway or Finland. Yeah, like, I don't think it's totally sure, but like the Laplands, like super cold.
Yeah, yes. But I just think it's interesting that like nobody would know where it is. Like there also, would be a lot of graduated students who would still know where it is. And like, how would that information, did they sign an NDA? Like,
what? I don't know. Could you imagine like what Dumbledore's NDA would look like oh what he would gosh. Write? Also something that Malfoy brings up going back to that conversation is that he knows something is afoot at Hogwarts.
Yeah, that's when he goes into their compartment and is talking to them.
Right.
Yeah, he knows what's going to happen at Hogwarts because Lucius has spilled the beans to him. The Weasleys were like trying to make it a surprise for Harry, Ron, and Hermione.
Bill and Charlie are like, oh, you guys are going to have fun this year. Molly's like, yeah, you are. And they have no idea what's going on. And Malfoy is just like, oh, you don't know about what's happening. Your dad didn't tell you because he's low level.
Yeah.
Jerk. So then they get to the school and we see the horseless carriages again. Just a quick note that this is the last year that these are going to appear horseless to Harry.
That's true.
And there's a lot of, we could talk about it probably more in the next book, but there is a lot of sort of debate or discussion around why Harry can't see the Thestrals, even though he has the memory of his parents dying. Something interesting I read, and I don't think it's canon at all, is that the memory Harry has of his mom dying, you know, he always hears the scream and such, is actually the memory of the Horcrux of Voldemort that is inside of Harry. And that's why he can't see the Thestrals.
I have never heard that theory, and that has intrigued me to my core.
Definitely Google it and like read through some of the thought around it, but it's very interesting to
me. Fan theory that I hear most often with that is like he was too young to understand it, so like it didn't make an impact on him like it does when you're older and you witness somebody die. Like when you're nine, when like Luna was nine and she saw her mother die, like that's old enough to understand what happened and see like if it's happened in front of you. But when you're 18 months old, like you don't, it doesn't like make an impact on you. You can't I don't know. Maybe there's a child psychologist listening who has something else to say. But that's, and it just like, even though he has like seen the memory in his head when he was like doing the Patronus with Lupin last year, by the way, Lupin is mentioned once in this chapter when they go into the Great Hall and Harry notices that there's no Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher yet. It's like, oh yeah, Harry's favorite was Lupin last year. That's literally the only mention we get. It frustrated me so much. There's no further dialogue. There's no like, and you know, this thing happened with him where he like, he was a, you know, Lupin's a werewolf and he sort of had an accident last year. And Harry really wondered how he was doing. He hadn't heard from him and he thought it was very strange, but he knew that Professor Lupin liked to, you know, like there's nothing. Where is it? Where is it?
And like,
Harry would wonder how Lupin is.
Wouldn't Sirius be writing to Lupin and have like some sort of update? Like, oh,
Sirius and Lupin are probably coordinating or corresponding. I'm assuming, you know, when your best friend gets out of Azkaban after 13 years, like
you'd want to have a beer or something.
But yeah, like they're probably not getting together because Sirius is on the run and Lupin's sad. But like, I'm assuming that he's so sad. He's such a sad man. But like, there's no like Harry's like. Lupin was Harry's favorite teacher, but Lupin is more than a teacher to Harry. There should be some like, Harry wondered how Lupin was doing. Anyway, I skipped way ahead. I'm sorry, but it made me so mad.
We get the sorting hat.
Yes. We're in chapter 12 now, called the Triwizard Tournament.
This is the first time
running amok.
Oh my gosh. Throwing water balloons.
they're already soaked because it's raining and he's like throwing water balloons on them.
This is the first time it's ever mentioned that the sorting hat belonged to Godric Gryffindor. That was not mentioned in the original sorting ceremony. It was so interesting. Like, I just love these nuggets that we're starting to get.
And the sorting hat says it itself. I was going to say himself, but I don't know if we can gender the sorting itself. And it sings a different sorting song. And it's like the history of the founders, which is really cool because we sort of got some founders history in Chamber of Secrets, but we don't know much about the founders at this point.
And we're not going to really get much more until we get into Horcrux hunting.
Yeah.
We get a list of, you know, the new students, one of which is little Dennis Creevy.
And he's
kind of makes me sad because I know the fate of the Creevy brothers and it is not good.
I don't want to talk about it yet. We're not there yet. I don't even want to scratch that surface. Given little Dennis Creevy his coat because it was cold and rainy.
I know, it's so cute. Another note I have here I found when doing research is there's a student called Natalie McDonald.
Yes. Oh my god.
What? Oh, so no, it's not actually what you're thinking it is. You're thinking related to Mary McDonald.
Yeah.
So Natalie McDonald was a little girl who was a huge Harry Potter fan in Toronto, Canada. And she unfortunately, very sadly, passed away from leukemia before this book was published and had written to the author. And so the author included her as a student.
That's sweet.
As a tribute.
That's very sweet.
But I guess it also makes sense because it would tie to Mary McDonald potentially.
Yeah, you said McDonald. I didn't even catch that. So we can talk about Mary McDonald in book five, but she's another one of those tiny once mentioned characters in canon that like we've taken and fleshed out into a whole person.
So she's the only like real life person name ever mentioned in a Harry Potter book. So it's sort of interesting.
That's really cool.
Yes.
Hermione learns about the house elves working in the kitchen. And she decides to go on a hunger strike because she will not touch food that has been prepared by slave labor.
She breaks pretty quickly.
You have to. Like, what are you going to, otherwise she won't eat. But, like, what a queen.
Harry has an interesting dream about, do you have anything else?
Well, no. We have to talk about Mad-Eye coming in.
Oh, yes.
So Mad-Eye Moody, or so we think, walks in and the ceiling in the Great Hall goes nuts and nobody really talks about it. It does and they're like noticing it but nobody comments on it.
Yeah, like Albus Dumbledore, greatest wizard of all time, is not like, this is strange.
Yeah, and in the movie we see like it starts raining on everybody and the students scream and then, you know, Moody goes, stupid ceiling. But that's like that we don't, nobody talks about it, but the ceiling goes nuts. It starts like flashing lightning. And so he hobbles in. Mad-Eye Moody's got a wooden leg and he's very scarred. He's like heavily scarred on his face and Harry sees on his hand. And I'm kind of wondering, how did he get so scarred?
He's like, missing an eyeball.
He's missing an eye. He's missing a chunk of his nose. Like he's mutilated. And I'm wondering how it happened because, you know, we know he fought in the first Wizarding War and he was like very, very successful at capturing dark wizards and like, they call him a dark wizard catcher and he filled out the spell box in Azkaban. But like when you're fighting dark wizards, like they're just trying to kill you mostly with the killing curse. And if you deflect that or like get away from it, like nothing happens to you. Like how is he getting so scarred? Like what, did he fight a dragon? Like what is happening? Like I want to know.
I don't know, but I think it's interesting. It adds, you know, this roughness
It gives him an atmosphere.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Funny that we don't get any language about Lupin the werewolf having any sort of facial scars or like.
Yeah. And that's actually an argument for why people think in the books it wasn't originally written. Like, we see Lupin with facial scars in the films on David Thewlis, but that's why people argue in the books that he didn't actually have facial scars in like book canon, because Harry doesn't notice them. And like, he notices Mad-Eye's scars and he thinks about it, and we get that description in the book, but like, Harry doesn't notice that about Lupin. But also, Harry's about as observant as like a doorknob, so we just don't know. He's not observant. So they start talking about the Triwizard Tournament. I want to dispel something like that happens in the TikTok community. There are a lot of people, and not to ruin your fun, you can continue making Yule Ball content all you want. I think it's very sweet. But I just want you to know, the Yule Ball only takes place when the Triwizard Tournament takes place.
Right.
In a year where the Triwizard Tournament doesn't take place, there's not a Yule Ball. Also, before 1994, this year, Harry's fourth year, the Triwizard Tournament hadn't taken place since 1792.
Yeah, so Lucius and Narcissa were not going to the Yule Ball together.
No, like, yeah, so like, a lot of people make like very sweet Yule Ball content, and like, continue making it. It's really cute. But just so you know, it's like, the Yule Ball didn't happen outside of this year, unless you're making content about wizards and witches prior to 1792.
Right. Another potential fancy occasion that people could have gone to, like, in that generation would have been slug club parties.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, that's just, I made a TikTok about that once and people were like, what? So yeah. Yule Ball.
As much as you would love an annual prom.
Like, why don't they have one?
I know, what a bore. Especially because like, Minerva loves to dance and like, Albus loves an occasion. You would think that they would like, throw these kids a prom, but.
Yeah, guess not.
Who would be decorating?
We have to deal with a couple of them like, almost dying every year.
Who would be on the decorating committee? At Potter prom.
I'm going to go with Pomona Sprout for the botanicals and Phileas Flitwick for all the charms that make everything look pretty.
Lavender Brown would for sure be on
she'd be like the committee. President.
Yeah.
Like the head of the committee. Yeah. I would think Luna would want to join and just like, have all these like, really quirky ideas that everybody would just shoot.
Hermione would probably like, coordinate seating charts. And
probably.
Like,
do some Excel spreadsheets. Yeah.
I think like, Seamus Finnegan would have been in charge of music. He looks like somebody love rock and roll.
I just like, on the whole, maybe this is generalizing, but this is a compliment. On the whole, Irish people are just like, good at music. They're just good at like, knowing good music and playing good music.
Who would be in charge of spiking the punch bowl?
Oh, Fred and George.
For sure.
And not even like, with alcohol, like with something that would like, turn your skin green. Like,
yeah, know, like everybody has like, purple tongues.
Yeah. There's also, so Dumbledore is discussing the Triwizard Tournament. He's like, you know, we've changed some rules so that no champion will find themselves like, dead at the end of this.
Didn't work.
Oh, it didn't work. Oh, yikes. And it doesn't, here's another thing that's different from the films. The other schools don't arrive, and the tournament doesn't start until October. It doesn't start till Halloween, I believe.
Yeah, which isn't well explained. And well, in the movies, like, everybody just shows up day one.
Yeah.
We just hop into it.
And Ron, you know, when they're leaving the Great Hall after they've eaten, or unless you're Hermione, Fred and George are like, talking about how cool it would be to like, trick whoever is picking the champions to let them enter. And they're like, you know, it's 1,000 galleons prize money. And it says Ron had a faraway, where is it? Ron, yeah, said Ron with a faraway look on his face. Yeah, 1,000 galleons. And this is sort of reminiscent of what happened at the Burrow with the dress robes. And then in the compartment when Malfoy was making fun of Ron's dress robes, which we didn't talk about. This is sort of like a continuation of Ron just being like, wishing he had more funds.
It's also kind of cute that the twins are talking about the prize money and winning it when they actually are going to be the recipients.
They're going to get, they're actually going to be the recipients of the prize money.
Yeah.
And then as they're, you know, settling into their dorms and falling asleep, I thought this was interesting. There's, you know, a big thing in the films is when Harry gets chosen as champion, spoiler, He's like, I didn't want it. I didn't ask
Imagine
for it.
If
like
he
I wouldn't
didn't get chosen as champion in this book. What would it be about?
Probably just like him spectating some lovely events. Like it would have been a much more normal year for Harry.
Harry Potter and the normal year of school.
Harry Potter and the I got to sit in the stands while Cedric Diggory fought a
Harry
dragon.
Harry Potter and I actually learned something this year.
I wasn't distracted with peril. But Harry's laying down to sleep and dreaming of being champion.
Yeah. Which is
like, it's not something he doesn't think about. It's not something he doesn't necessarily desire.
Yeah, and I think there is something about, and this dream made me remember that Harry was very close to being placed in Slytherin.
Right.
And there is something, call it the Voldemort soul effect or something, but there is something about Harry that does value ambition and winning and being on top.
Yeah, and we see it in Quidditch.
Right. He doesn't, you know, he takes that seriously. He likes the attention of being the seeker. He likes what that brings. I think what's specific to Harry is that he likes to do something and receive the attention from his like accolade, from accomplishing something and being good at something.
Yeah.
And I think what Harry doesn't like is that a lot of attention has been paid to him for something he doesn't necessarily think he deserves attention about. You know, what he knows about how his parents died is that his mother gave her life to protect him. And a lot of people, you know, come to Harry and they're like, you saved the Wizarding World from Voldemort. And I imagine he, again, this is just like my speculating, but I imagine he feels very much like, well, that was really my parents' sacrifice. And I was just a baby.
I fully agree. I totally agree. That's a brilliant analysis.
So I think Harry is ambitious. I think he does like to be on top. I think he likes the attention. You know, we see it here and there. This dream, definitely a big sign.
But he does like to work for it.
But he likes hard work and he likes to be good at something and to deserve it.
By the way, Quidditch has been canceled this year because of the Triwizard Tournament, which has just got to suck a little bit after getting that Firebolt.
Yeah, that's not good. We also see and his crush on
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He mentions how he's like, I kind of wish I was sitting at the Ravenclaw table. And
oh, cute.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else?
No, that's it. We are next time going to be looking at chapters 13 through 16. I think we get to meet Mad-Eye Moody, certainly. I think we get to meet the new people from the new schools. It's going to be really fun kicking off the Triwizard Tournament.
Learn about some unforgivable curses.
Yikes. I hate that part.
I know. It's not good.
It's not good. It's not good, especially considering like Mad-Eye Moody's situation this year.
So
real bad.
Leave a review on Apple Podcasts and you might be chosen in the next episode.
For us to
read aloud.
The podcast. Yeah. We thank you guys so much for spending time with us and we'll see you next week.
Yeah. See you next week, friends. Hey, thanks for listening to our latest episode. As always, please subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. And if you're not a listener on Apple Podcasts, it would still help us out a lot if you head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. If you have any questions, comments, concerns about anything you heard in this episode today, please drop us a line at our Anchor profile. You can leave us a nifty little voice message there, or you can head to our Instagram @thedailyprofcast to DM us or leave us an email.